They will be reclining on arrayed couches, and we will wed them to big-eyed houris. The faithful and their descendants who followed them in faith, we will make their descendants to join them, and we will not stint anything from their deeds. Every person is a pledge of what he has earned. The rewards for the people of paradise will be both spiritual and material bounties. For them to recline upon will be luxurious couches of the finest and most comfortable type, immaculately arranged in ranks. God Almighty shall marry them to houris, having wide and lovely eyes, as compensation for their abstinence from sins and whatever was religiously forbidden. The next ayah gives tidings to the true believers and the virtuous children and progenies they had groomed by instilling in their hearts faith and God-weariness, that they shall be joined in paradise by their offspring without the least effect on the rewards reserved for them. It is narrated from the Prophet of Islam by his first infallible successor, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. True believers and their offspring shall be in paradise reciting this ayah. Of course, God, the All-Merciful, forgives those who repent and reform themselves through compensation for the imperfections of their deeds. And the rejoining of members of a family in paradise is thus part of divine favors. These ayahs teach us that, number one, paradise is the place of chastity, virtue, and morality, where men and women will be legally and lawfully bonded together in the sanctity of wedlock and not any form of licentiousness. Number two, those who abstain from casting indecent looks in the world will receive beautiful spouses in paradise. Number three, in Islam, faith is the base for building a virtuous family. Thus, the true believers will be joined by their virtuous spouses and offspring in paradise. And number four, the need of a spouse and children is part of innate human nature that will be preserved in paradise as well by the Almighty Creator.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence. with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witnessed that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discourse among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis, and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt a.s. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone. And we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizza, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Analysts believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belongs to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is highly respected among Afghan people because of his leadership role in resisting invasion and Takfiri groups in the region. Afghans consider him as a hero who inspired them to find freedom and defeat the invaders. To commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani's sacrifices and bravery, Afghan leaders, clerics, and experts gathered at the Iranian embassy in Kabul, highlighting his role in unifying Muslims and forming an anti-terror resistance in the region, especially Afghanistan.
Martyr Soleimani was a righteous servant of God. He was committed to Islam's holy values and ideals, so he devoted his life to serve Muslims and the oppressed and fight devils and Takfiri groups. He fought the U.S. hegemony in the region and didn't let it interfere in Islamic countries' affairs and create terror and war in the region.
Martyr Soleimani managed to unify Muslims around the globe. He always used to show up wherever he was needed. For Afghanistan, he was a friend. He met resistance forces and Afghan top leaders to motivate and empower them to defend their soil against terrorists and invaders. Therefore, we owe the victory over the U.S. to the anti-terror, General Soleimani.
Some Afghan teenagers, considering themselves as the followers of Lieutenant General Soleimani's school of thought, have held the Sanda Wushu match on the occasion of the second anniversary of the martyrdom of their fearless role model.
All matches held here in support of Commander Soleimani. We, the young generation of Afghanistan, are followers of his school of thought. We love the commander's attitude and adopt him as our role model in bravery, faith, and modesty. That is why most matches are named after him.
Lieutenant General Soleimani not only played a major role in defeating Daesh terrorist group in Syria and Iraq, but also had a direct relation with Afghan resistance forces to help them defeat terrorist groups and put an end to invasion on their soil. Afghans marked the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as they are still suffering from time-to-time Daesh attacks. For Afghans, Martyr Soleimani is a hero and a role model for fighting against terrorism. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The second anniversary of the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was marked with a lecture which detailed the life and good works of the former leader of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. The participants praised the sterling quality of his character, especially his selfless fight against terrorist groups.
He was killed for his fight against this terrorism, and he need to be remembered. We must remember General Qasem Soleimani for his bravery and standing against injustice. He fight against the extrajudicial killing of innocent people by the so-called ISIS and other terrorist organizations.
General Soleimani and his fellow Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were assassinated in a targeted drone attack on the 3rd of January 2020 in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, with orders from then U.S. President Donald Trump. People here say the assassination of General Soleimani has revealed the true identity of terror sponsors to the world.
Those that claim to be fighting against terrorism kill a hero, somebody who fights against terrorism. Now, who are the terrorists? America is the perpetrators of terrorism in the world. It is very clear to the whole world that these are the global sponsors and perpetrators of terrorism in the world.
Military hospital.
In a message to the occasion, Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki said the Islamic movement in Nigeria will continue to mark the assassination of General Soleimani, just like it marks other martyrs in Karbala, Zaria, and other places. Nigerians who gathered here say they share the pain of the Iranian people and indeed of all law-abiding nations of the world who stand against extrajudicial killing like that of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. government. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he's an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Palestinian journalists have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on Facebook, a claim backed by rights groups. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, has rejected the claim, saying its policies were designed to give everyone a voice, but Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have been simmering for years and were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said the platform had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights violations by Israel. According to a Palestinian social media monitoring center, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021 alone. Joining us now from Ramallah is our correspondent, Mona Candy. Mona, how alarming are these findings?
Well, recently it was very clear that journalists and social media activists, when posting anything on Facebook, clearly mentioning the word, let's say, for example, martyr or martyrdom, or even Israeli crimes, massacres, that immediately Facebook would remove or delete such posts. Facebook has been removing these posts, claiming they violated the platform's standards. But Palestinians, as you have mentioned, see these claims as a pro-Israeli bias at Facebook, because when it comes to mentioning the Israeli crimes, when it comes to mentioning some issues in the occupied territories, then they would be seen as violating the platform Facebook standards. Palestinians today are saying that Facebook is simply having double standards, is simply backing the Israeli narration. Why it's only the Palestinians who are suffering from these especially this treatment. Multiple incidents happened and they are seen as censorship. According to Palestinian social media monitoring center, Sada Social said that at least 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were deleted or restricted. We can say that every day a number of Palestinians are being restricted to post anything. It's considered as a punishment just for addressing the Israeli crimes and just for posting some Israeli shootings that are carried out against Palestinians, or even if they write the word martyr in Arabic or martyrdom as well.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candy, joining us from Ramallah. Let's now take a look at the tail of the tape of our guest for Spotlight. Founding director of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies from San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdullah, joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Rabab Abdul Hadi joining us from San Francisco. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have simmered for years. Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Is Facebook suppressing freedom of speech?
Yes, definitely. There is a lot of evidence of that. The most recent attack has been the big campaign that Palestinian social media bloggers posted, which entitled Facebook Censors Jerusalem. And it was basically where Facebook basically blocked every single post in which Palestinians will, as your reporter said, mention the word martyr, shaheed, prisoner, Jerusalem. They shut down the two big networks in Jerusalem. They shut down accounts for multiple Palestinians and so on. Facebook claimed that this was about their algorithm. But the question is that the algorithm is designed by people. So who plays these words to make them blocked by algorithm? But I think there is a bigger picture too, that Facebook has historically and continuously continued to block Palestinian content. I can just mention maybe a couple of examples historically by Facebook actually going and making a deal with the Israeli government, Facebook collaborating with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which task is to actually block and silence Palestinian voices and Palestinian advocacy voices for Palestinian liberation around the world. Facebook also, Zuckerberg, met with the Israelis multiple times. They hired as one of the major media people in Facebook a former officer of the Israeli government who is known to be anti-Palestinian. I know from our own experience at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies program that Facebook has been targeted by several pro-Zionist groups that have tried to shut us down, starting in 2013 with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is in Los Angeles, which has been built, the so-called Museum of Tolerance, on the land of the Palestinian cemetery, Ma'manillah, Mamila in Jerusalem. It was followed by my provost, my own academic provost, demanding that I take down a post in which I criticize my university president for welcoming Zionists to campus, which is supposed to be my own academic freedom. And the post that I posted was actually, I shared the post from one of our student groups, Jews Against Zionism, who said that they are opposed to welcoming Zionism on campus because of its colonialism, its racism, its apartheid. And it had a picture of a young student who was saying, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm anti-Zionist, I'm not anti-Semitic, free Palestine. And so they thought that this was actually a violation. The university provost demanded that I take it down. The dean demanded that I take it down. And I said, no, I'm not going to be doing it. This is my academic freedom, as was condemned by the university president and the chancellor. But then afterwards, also last year, Facebook shut down our page completely, took down years of archives, of online classes, of syllabi, of material, of everything else. They are not explaining why they have done
that. Let's bring in Charlotte Cates on the discussion as well, Ms. Cates. Similar calls were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said that Facebook had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues speaking about human rights violations carried out by Israelis. So the claim is not just coming from Palestinian sources. Why is this happening, in your opinion? Why is information pointing out Israeli human rights violations and crimes? Are they being suppressed and concealed?
Well, when we look at the role of these big tech companies, so we've got Facebook, Twitter, Zoom, these kinds of big tech companies, they are engaged in shaping a narrative that works hand in hand with U.S. imperialism. These are some of the largest corporations that are currently based in the United States. And so we're seeing that being weaponized against Palestinian discourse, the censorship of words like martyrs, the censorship of the names of Palestinian political parties and organizations, in order to serve the interests, frankly, of U.S. imperialism and its alliance with the Israeli occupation. We see the same thing taking place in which content from countries targeted by sanctions and U.S. imperialism is labeled as state-sponsored content, while the same kind of content from official sources, for example, from the BBC or a German-sponsored media agency, are not labeled as state-sponsored content. And so this is an attack by big tech to control the access of to information that people have around the world because of the fact that Palestinians have been so successful in breaking the silence imposed upon the Palestinian cause by mainstream media and corporate media and imperialist states through their creative and active use of social media, technology, and various methods of communication.
Sure. Ms. Abdulhadi, an account of a Palestinian journalist was restricted twice this year, once just in December when videos depicting Israeli attacks on Palestinians were posted. In both cases, Facebook said it intervened because the posts violated the platform's standards. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, said that its policies were designed to give everyone a voice while keeping them safe on our apps, also adding, quote, we apply these policies to everyone equally, regardless of who is posting. Is that the case?
Well, actually, that's definitely not the case. And there is so many flaws in this argument. One is that when they say they are applying equally, who is applying equally? And who's really setting the standards? And according to whom? And who's participating in it? We know there are high officials in Facebook who are setting it thus in consultation with various governments. They have done it again and again and again. So it's actually the whole question of equal is really not true, and it's inaccurate labeling to say to start with. Secondly, the whole question of how they are setting up is also a question. Third is that why is it that Facebook is also shutting down, as my colleague Charlotte Kate said, shutting down posts also from, for example, on Kashmir liberation. They're shutting down posts on any other liberation around the world and actually allowing a lot of weaponizing of hate speech, of violence, of incitement to be there and succumbing to the pressures from various Israeli groups and various hate groups, various racist groups and so on. And it has to do with the fact that we're dealing with the Silicon Valley and we're dealing with Facebook as well as Zoom and other platforms, which are very much profit-related, and they are only concerned with their alliances, and they're not really concerned with the truth and justice. They are only concerned with actually adding more ads and getting more people to subscribe. And so they believe that if they are suppressing Palestine, that might actually work. The problem with that is that it will always backfire, because there is more and more people supporting Palestine. There is more and more people recognizing what's going on. Major human rights violation. Major human rights organizations have already documented and stated what has happened. Major electronic groups, such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others, have also documented what has been going on. So Facebook is actually really stuck now, having to explain what is going on. So they're backpedaling to cover up the wrong that they are doing by aligning themselves with Israel and its racist and colonialist policies,
right,
and by suppressing Palestinian voices.
Right. Charlotte Cates, do you recall the issue? I think it was from earlier this year when young teenage girls were being targeted by sexual predators on Facebook. We spoke to a staff member right here on our channel from the company who alluded to lax protocols for monitoring content on Facebook. So let's hit pause there and come back to the issue that we're talking about right now regarding Palestinian posts. A Meta spokesperson said that it has a, quote, dedicated team which includes Arabic and Hebrew speakers who are focused on keeping our community safe by making sure we're removing harmful content. So which is it? They have a team of watchful eyes for pro-Palestinian content, but the pedophiles aren't as harmful?
Well, it's sad. If we look at May of this year, May of 2021, during the Unity Uprising throughout occupied Palestine, Facebook was seemingly a very safe place for hateful content by Zionist extremists encouraging violence in occupied Palestine 48 and participating in the ongoing riots targeting Palestinians in Palestine 48, assistance of the Israeli occupation army. And we've seen that systematically in hateful, racist, openly, blatantly racist content in the sources is deemed to be acceptable, while merely listing the name of a Palestinian political party like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, or the Popular Front for Palestine in a news article makes that same information dangerous by Facebook. And so what we see is that these big tech companies bring out the narrative of the Israeli occupation and of U.S. imperial Palestinian content. So it's also quite a safe space for forms of racist hatred, white supremacy, Zionist for Palestinian content and for internationalist content, imperialism. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians by Zionists. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians living under the bombs in Gaza, in exile around the world, or in being targeted by the guns of the occupier in the West Bank and Jerusalem or Palestine 48. Palestinian safety is considered to be something that is not the responsibility of Facebook, just like the Israeli mutual approach that's taken with the Israeli occupation. We've seen time and time again that there are actually thousands and tens of thousands of reports filed by the Israeli occupation regime with Facebook on a regular basis. And we saw in 2015 during the Al-Quds uprising that was taking place that Israeli occupation essentially put strong pressure on Facebook and threatened to ban it within the country. And while Facebook was already a big tech company kind of serving U.S. interests, after 2015, we saw a dramatic escalation in the number of Palestinian posts being taken down and targeted because of this ongoing coordination that was established between Facebook and the Israeli occupation state.
Okay, Ms. Abdul-Hadi, according to Palestinian Social Media Monitoring Center, Sada Social, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021. We said that's a record for the year. So the Palestinians, basically, they face an asymmetrical battle both on the ground and also in the media. What alternatives does that leave for the Palestinians? I think that's where many observers and commentators come in and say that resistance is the only alternative for Palestinians at this point.
Yes, of course. Palestinians, I should just say that, have been resisting for over 100 years the Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. The resistance is not new. It continues and it keeps escalating and it keeps including more and more people. And every single time Israel succeeds in crushing a major defeat by conducting massacres, by killing hundreds of people and so on, that has happened multiple times around Gaza. That is happening sometimes silently, not even reported in the media, in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, in the Old City, in Lid, in Akka, in Haifa, in Bir Sabah, in Naqab. This is happening all the time. And I think biggest part of the problem for Israel and its supporters, including Facebook, is that they have been unable to crush Palestinian resistance. They have been unable to say that this is a land without people for a people without a land. They failed. Israel has failed. Zionism has failed to do so. So they are escalating their aggression and their attempt to silencing and crush using the money accounts that they have with the pressures of the Facebook and Silicon Valley and so on. They're using the pressures with the Israeli Ministry of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. For example, there is this app called ACT-IL that sent 19,000 messages to Zoom to shut down an open classroom that my colleague Tomomi Kenekawa and I were organizing last year with the Palestinian feminist icon Leila Khaled. They continue doing this again and again. Sada Social is totally 100% correct in what is going on. So this means that, of course, Palestinians will continue resisting. They have no choice but to resist. A people that is suppressed is always going to yearn to be free. It will resist. It will continue to resist by every single aspect available to them, including the many Palestinian social media activists who are raising the voices high and making it known to us that there is censorship that is going on. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. People who are not inside Palestine and so on would not know what's going on. And the fact that the world is responding, the world is condemning what Israel is doing. We would like the world to be a little bit faster in that, so less Palestinian lives and less lives all around are being lost. But the Palestinians have no choice. They have to resist, and they will continue on resisting until all Palestine is free.
Right. Charlotte, Kate, one angle of all of this is trying to align anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, if you criticize Israel, then you're being an anti-Semite. But we know that many Jews, even Israeli Jews, that criticize Israel for its rights violations and crimes. Is this just another way of trying to control the narrative, in your opinion?
This is another example of the attempt to turn reality on its head. The reality is that the Palestinian Liberation Movement is an anti-fascist, anti-colonial movement that is on the side of all people who are fighting against racism, oppression, and discrimination and all. On the other hand, the Zionist movement is fundamentally a fascism that is based on racism, colonialism, and so by invoking the concept of when really Zionism is itself an anti-Semitic thing, the concept of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish prejudice, the leaders of Israeli war crimes and Israeli apartheid are attempting to change the discourse to focus instead on the idea that Palestinian colonialism and fighting back to defend their rights are somehow the oppressors in the nation. It's an attempt to turn reality on its head. In reality, if we want to, you know, anti-Jewish oppression, anti-Semitism, just like all forms of racism, this means standing hand in hand with the Palestinian liberation struggle, not hand in hand with the Zionist movement, which has increasingly built its ties with every far-right and fascist regime around the world, regardless of their position on the crimes of the Nazis, regardless of their position on fascism. That's who the Israeli state is aligned with, okay. Is the far right, is the fascist forces.
Well, let's get a final thought in from Ms. Abdul Hadi. I'd like to get your thoughts on the same issue. Is all of this happening to control the narrative, making the previous statement that we just mentioned some kind of default, that if you're anti-Israeli, then you're an anti-Semite and you must be shunned and banned and silenced?
I would just say three points about this in addition to what we've already heard from your guest, Charlotte Gates. One is that, yes, they are trying to control the narrative. The Palestinian narrative is a narrative of resistance, of resilience, of steadfastness. Zionism is trying to impose a narrative of submission, subjugation, and defeat, and they are, of course, trying to do that. This is failing. This is something that actually is going on. That's one thing that's really, really important. Secondly, what does this really mean? It means that for all of us not to be silent, for all of us to say we will not be silenced, we're actually going to escalate and raise every single voice of Palestine high and amplify the Palestinian demands to be able to speak, to be able to express, to be able to reflect the reality on the ground to the outside world. The final point I would say is that there is so many more support for Palestine all over. Zionism, claiming that that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, is failing also among multiple and broader ranks of Jews, not to mention other people around the world who are seeking justice. At the end of the day, Zionism has really failed, but that's why also bullies become bullier, become more vicious when they are whenever they are failing. The only solution is for us to continue resisting, raising our voices, speaking up, and saying we will not be silenced.
Indeed, and that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, founding director at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdul-Hadi, joining us from San Francisco, and also thanks to Ms. Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver. And thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.